Chapter 4, Kansas City, Missouri, 1976 to 1979. My old Mercury had died, and now I drove a beat-to-shit VW Bug. The fenders were held on with riveted sheet metal patches. I had a few clothes and a cheap stereo. As such, I didn't have much to haul to KCMO. I was pretty excited about this new phase of my life, even though I had no idea what lay ahead. I didn't realize until decades later that the driving force behind so many of my decisions was my craving for a little chaos. I began my drive to Kansas City in mid-February 1977. 60 miles beyond Cleveland, while I was driving down the off-ramp to get gas, the VW died. I was pissed. It could have been worse, though. I could have been at the midpoint between two exits 30 miles apart. If you haven't noticed already, when I look at my cup of life, it's always half full. A service station sat at the end of the exit ramp, so I was able to coast right to it. Biff, the head mechanic, told me he would not be able to look at the car until the next morning. Fortunately, there was a hotel next door, and I settled in for the night on Cardinal Publishing's tab. By the time I got to the gas station the next morning, the car was fixed, no charge. It was only a loose battery cable, and Biff tightened it in 10 seconds. Shit, I could have done that. I had to remember, though, that for the many times my vehicles have expired on me, I have never been able to figure out the problem by lifting the hood and looking at the engine. This would have been no different. I was housed in the Holiday Inn in Kansas City, along with one other out-of-town salesman. I discovered that I liked some aspects of living in a hotel. Maid service, free ice, remote-controlled television, a bathroom all to myself. These were comforts I wasn't used to. The next day I reported to a small office somewhere in downtown Kansas City, much like the one in downtown Cleveland. Jim Juthas gave me a warm greeting, handed me my lead cards and a map, and told me, "Have at it." I'm sure I stood there and stared at him for a few seconds, hoping that instead he was going to say something like, "Tidy, we think that Cardinal Publishing might be much better served with you as our office manager, developing leads and scheduling salesmen." But all he said was, "Have at it." There were two other crew members, Ted from Kansas City, Kansas, who lived at home, and Brian from Parts Unknown, who was housed in the hotel one floor below me. Ted's father owned a huge popcorn company. It supplied the wholesale market, movie theaters, carnivals, etc., with popcorn, popped and unpopped, and the popcorn popping machines, popcorn oil, salt, popcorn boxes, and bags. I asked Ted why he didn't work for his father. He said he used to, but wanted to see if he could make it on his own without popcorn cushioning his efforts. I thought he was nuts. I didn't know much about the popcorn business, but I knew this job with Cardinal Publishing was a dead end. He seemed like an awfully nice guy. I didn't try to discourage him. I hoped he would be successful in something. I didn't care much for Brian. He was my height, stocky, and had dark, curly hair. He was a mouthy, lonely soul. Lonely because he was mouthy, I suspected. During our off hours, Brian invited me down to his room to play backgammon. I had barely heard of the game and did not know how to play it. Brian was all too willing to show me. After two or three lessons, when he figured I was ready, we started playing. From this point on, Brian exhibited the incredibly annoying habit of exclaiming after most of my moves, "Geez, Jim, that was stupid," or, "Christ, what the hell did you do that for?" The only thing I wondered was why I sat there taking his abuse when I would have been perfectly happy by myself in my room, remote in one hand, Coors in the other, sprawled out on the bed with my shoes on, watching Gilligan's Island. For the duration of my job with Cardinal Publishing, my average paycheck was $30 a week. That left me just enough money to eat, very little, and put gas, 68 cents a gallon, into the VW. A couple of weeks into the job, Jim called me on a Saturday afternoon and invited me to his room for a drink. I was broke, had nothing to do, no longer hung out with Brian, had acquired a taste for alcohol and really liked Jim. Jim was of Greek descent, and probably still is. Like a lot of Greeks who drink, Jim really enjoyed ouzo. Although I'm a lousy salesman, I love listening to good salesmen or saleswomen talk. Regardless of the subject, they seem to inject it with the same persuasive fervor. Not that every subject passionately delivered is enjoyable to listen to, but Jim became one of my favorite storytellers. I also discovered that I enjoyed drinking ouzo. I loved the sweet licorice flavor. I loved watching the clear liquid tumble over the ice and magically turn cloudy. It was like Mr. Science pouring your drink. I can just hear him now. Okay, kids, now see how the liquid in this bottle is clear? Okay, now watch the chemical reaction when the polymers and coagulants from this clear liquid react and turn cloudy when they come in contact with the cold, clear ice. Wasn't that amazing? And kids, if you think that's amazing, wait until you experience the metaphysical changes in your head, sense of balance, touch, taste, your personality, after you've knocked down 6 ounces of this stuff. Little Jimmy Tidyman throws his hand in the air and shouts, "Me first, Mr. Science, me first." Jim was away from home like the rest of us and enjoyed my company. He may have been a bit dismayed at my love of and capacity for depleting his ouzo supply almost as quickly as he did, but he never said anything. Unlike my games of backgammon with Brian, Jim and I spent more than a few hours together yammering and drinking his ouzo until the job ended. And the job did end. I finally convinced Jim that I was not a salesman. See? In the end, I did sell something. Cardinal Publishing shared an office floor as well as a secretary with a few other businesses. The secretary, Nancy, was dating Dale, a captain in the fire department. Because the fire department shifts ran 24 hours on and 48 hours off, many firefighters had second jobs or second businesses. Dale was no exception. His was a small asphalt company specializing in driveways and small parking lots. His entire crew consisted of 4 firefighters. One day, late into my short career with Cardinal Publishing, I told Nancy that I wanted to stay in KC, and did she know of anyone looking to hire someone with my unique set of skills. Having spilled my guts to Nancy when I wasn't setting up sales calls, she wasn't quite sure what those unique skills were, but figured being a manual laborer might fit. How about laying asphalt for $5 an hour? My boyfriend owns an asphalt company. He's always looking for help. Your hair is a little long, but if you're interested, I'll talk to him. She did. He and I talked. He hired me. I became an asphalt laborer. Laying asphalt is a tough job. Laying asphalt in Kansas City in the summer is really tough. Kansas City has some of the shittiest weather I've ever experienced, and I've lived in a lot of places. Summer in KC is incredibly hot and humid. In fact, it was so hot we started laying asphalt at 6 in the morning. When it was really hot, we quit by noon because the asphalt would never harden and the rollers would sink into the surface. In short, it was almost as hot on the ground as it was in the asphalt furnace. Even though I was the only non-firefighter or civilian on the crew, I didn't have any trouble getting accepted. I wasn't exactly threatening, and they always needed another willing hand. I was punctual, I never called in sick, and I worked really hard, or at least as hard as I could. One day we were laying asphalt on a driveway. In order to fill in the corners and curves of the apron, we had to hand shovel huge scoops of asphalt, called dirt, from the feeder bin. Dale would call out to me in his inimitable style, "Todman, get me a scoop of dirt over here." After I dropped the asphalt where he wanted, he said, "Good, go get me 3 or 4 more scoops." This asphalt was really heavy, and these shovels were really big. By the time I got the second or third scoop of dirt, Dale noticed that my shovel was only half full. I was so goddamn exhausted at this point, I couldn't lift a full shovel of asphalt out of the bin. Dale looked at it and said, "What the hell is that, a half a scoop?" Yeah, I said. "In that case, half a scoop, go get me 8 more. For the rest of the time I worked for Dale, everyone on the crew called me half a scoop. With the riches from my asphalt job, I rented a $100 a month one-bedroom apartment in a condemned building. It was not as bad as it sounds. In fact, it wasn't until I lived there for 3 or 4 months that I noticed the sticker on the front door that said condemned. Despite the claim on my resume that I was a keen observer and detail-oriented worker, I was not. My apartment was on the first floor facing Main Street and was only 3 blocks from Country Club Plaza. Even though I was living in a roach-infested, lead-paint-peeling, crumbling apartment building, it was near a very nice neighborhood. The job with Dale was seasonal and would end by mid-September. I had no idea what I was going to do next, but get me another scoop, Dale did. Dale owned a small commercial building 2 blocks from a high school. Since he didn't have any tenants in the space, he thought it might be a good idea to open up an ice cream and hot dog shop, taking advantage of the high school trade. I would be the manager, and he would build a complete apartment for me in the rear of the store. I initially thought it was a great idea. It certainly solved my working and living questions. We started remodeling the inside the following week. While I helped him lay the tile, paint the walls, and run the plumbing, in the back of my mind I thought this might not be such a good idea after all. I was 28, single, horny, and soon to be the manager of a sweet shop catering to high school kids, girls, and I would have a full apartment in the rear. Dale didn't try out any other names for the place. In an inspiration, Uncle Newt's Conan Bun just came to him. He picked me up on a Saturday morning so we could go into the place and continue the remodeling. The first thing we saw when we opened the door was an inch of water with all the new linoleum tile curling and peeling up from the floor. Apparently, a water line we had just installed the day before had sprung a leak overnight, flooding the place. For a man of little patience like Dale, this was the first and last straw. He looked at the floor for 20 seconds and then announced, "Fuck it!" I myself knew enough to know that the broken water line probably saved me from going to jail. After the demise of Newts, my fellow workers suggested I apply to be a firefighter. They knew from a reliable municipal government grapevine that the city was getting ready for a big hiring push. I figured, why not? If I could clean bird baths, cut lawns, shovel snow, sell shoes, process aerial film, ferry pilots from the tarmac, screw up loading film while riding in the doorway of a helicopter, sell advertising, and scoop asphalt, surely I could be a firefighter. For some reason, the city of Kansas City didn't ask me for a resume. I'm glad it didn't. It would have been hard to create a work summary that wasn't all over the map. A fire department administrator at City Hall interviewed me, did a background check, screened me for drugs, and tested my aptitude. Much to my delight, I was hired. I would be paid $12,000 a year. It was significantly more than I had ever earned in my young life. I was ecstatic. We trained at the Firefighter Academy 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, for 8 weeks. We learned the theory, practical application, and execution of firefighting. Nothing, of course, can replace the real thing. No one ever started any fires for us to confront or filled the training tower with smoke from which we would had to escape, but we did learn how to pull hose from the back of a truck and to catch a fire hydrant. For example, wrap the tail end of a hose around the plug while letting the hose in the truck unravel as the truck moved forward. We learned how to rappel from the 6th floor of the tower, raise and extend ladders, and perform many other life-saving feats of daring. I found one piece of firefighting equipment very memorable. In the Kansas City Fire Department, it was a heavy brass nozzle, 4 inches in diameter at its base, tapering down to a 2-inch-wide opening. It was 3 feet long and called a fly pipe. It had 3 feeder inlet connectors for hoses to be attached to 3 fire hydrants. Once it was turned on, it required 2 strong firefighters to aim it into a flaming window or to guide it wherever it needed to go. There was only one reason to use a fly pipe. It was to pour just as much water as fast as it would travel onto a fire. To initiate the flow of water from this behemoth, a firefighter near or in the building signaled the fly pipe operator to turn on the water. One of the first of many important things you learn in fly pipe training is that after you have called for the fly pipe to flow, do not, under any circumstances, get anywhere near its path. In a real fire and in real training, the fly pipe is primed to release a continuous stream of thousands of gallons of high-pressure water. You do not want to be in its way, and practically all of us listen to that advice. One day, six of us were sitting in the fourth floor room of this cement training tower, getting ready to signal the other trainees on the ground to turn on the fly pipe. When instructed, we called for water and waited, and waited, and waited. We all sat off to the side of the room, expecting the water to come flying through the window at any moment. Apparently, the wait was too much for trainee Tony. Tony was a little guy. I say that about guys who are about the same height as I am. I think of them as looking small. I wonder, but not very often, if they size me up the same way. Tony weighed 130 pounds. At the time, I weighed 155. Tony, in his impatience, crawled over to the window and stuck his head out to see what was holding up the water. In fact, the water was already on its way. As soon as his head inched into the window opening, his face was blasted with the water. Its force caused him to do a backward somersault that plastered him up against the far wall. He would have somersaulted two more times had the wall been set back just a bit more. Our shock followed Tony's by a nanosecond, and our laughter was in direct proportion to his pain. Tony took away three things from this experience: temporary blindness, a lesson in patience, and a new nickname, Flypipe. I was assigned to a recently built fire station in a new industrial park. To this day, I doubt whether the industrial park has had a building catch on fire, ergo, it was pretty damn boring. The first fire I went to while stationed there was a grass and weeder. Some grass and weeds had caught fire in an open lot, probably from a lit cigarette butt being thrown out of a car window. I had been trained in the proper use of fire hoses, axes, ladders, breathing apparatus, fly pipes, etc. But the first thing I was handed when we pulled up to this mildly smoldering mound on the side of the road was a broom. I approached it with the same confidence and bravado I did with any other job requiring a broom. It wasn't long before I had the conflagration under control. There were no casualties. 2 weeks into the job, I was in the fire station kitchen slicing a turkey breast when the knife slipped. It landed right on the top of my middle finger and cut through close to the knuckle. Like any kitchen knife cut, it happened fast, hurt a little, and bled a lot. This was no exception. My captain wrapped it in a few sheets of paper towel. We jumped onto the pumper truck and headed to the hospital, where I received 6 stitches across my finger. The upshot from this on-the-job injury was that I was placed on inactive duty at full pay until the stitches came out, almost 2 weeks. What a job. By 6 p.m. I was home, and by 7:30 in Mike's Tavern, where I met up with my pal Bill. Over our first beer, we both agreed that it was one of the best on-the-job injuries you could get. After a few months of this death-defying work, I put in for a transfer to a busier station. I soon learned that there were as many firefighters looking for a sleepy station as there were looking for a busy one. I was transferred to station number 17. Station 17 was one of the busiest firehouses in the city, located as it was in one of the poorer sections of town. It had a hook and ladder truck, a pump truck, and a 2-man paramedic wagon. I was assigned to the hook and ladder. My captain was Chuck, who had a medium build, stone gray hair, was noticeably pigeon-toed, and a chain smoker. He was also a hell of a nice guy, very easygoing, and a delight to work for. The day I met him, he said to me, "Tidyman, just so we understand each other, there's two things you never say to me. One, you never say anything about my feet. And two, you never ask me what's up, followed by my first name. Easy enough. For the entire time I was stationed there, we got along great. The responsibilities of the hook and ladder crew were different from those of the pump truck and paramedic crews. Of course, we were all there to save lives and property, but each crew had slightly different responsibilities to reach that end. For instance, the hook and ladder crew didn't have much to do with hosing down buildings unless we were assisting the pump truck crew. Our primary jobs were to break down doors and windows in order to find access to burning buildings, to cut holes in walls, ceilings, and roofs in order to let smoke escape, to set small, medium, and large ladders against the sides of structures, and to raise the extension ladders on the truck for elevated positioning to fight the fire or to rescue people. Once we were inside the burning structure, our job was to rescue inhabitants, tear down walls, and to help find the source of the fire. At the same time, we assisted the pump truck crews with hoses. As a new firefighter, I was told to stick close to my captain. No sense in dying so soon after graduating from firefighter school. For the first few months at Station 17, we were on the 24 hours on, 48 hours off shift. You could expect to go out on an alarm at least a few times, maybe more, during your 24 hours at this station. It was that kind of neighborhood. Rarely did we go days without going out at all. One morning, as I showed up for work, we had an alarm for an old apartment building. It was rapidly filling up with smoke. As soon as we arrived, I was instructed to go around to the side of the building to open a few of the ground-level windows and help some of the residents get out. As soon as I got to the first window, I saw a mother holding what looked like a 3-month-old baby. She stood inside screaming to open the window. I did. As soon as I opened it, I reached in to take the baby from her, but didn't realize that the window sash was broken. About the time that the baby's head was in line with the bottom of the window, it dropped down and cracked him on the forehead. I don't know who screamed louder, the baby, the mother, or me. I remember what the mother was screaming. "You're killing my baby! God damn it, you're killing my baby!" In an instant, I had the baby cradled in one arm. I held the window up with the other, and the woman crawled out with a few other frightened folks behind her. She snatched her baby and stalked off. I knew the baby was fine because I could still hear the crying. I had been told that if you're crying, you're probably not hurt that bad and you'll be fine. That wasn't Captain G's advice. That was what my dad told me when I was 4 years old and got stung by a bee. It's always been true for me, especially when I'm crying. One call had us going to a 4-story retirement apartment building. We had to raise the ladder on the truck to get up to the 3rd floor, where residents were evacuating through the window. I had to go up the ladder to assist some of these seniors down the ladder. I still get shivers thinking about the 85-pound, 80-year-old woman in a nightgown coming down the ladder. I had to stand behind her, guiding each step as she slowly made her way down to earth. The shivers didn't come from the fear of height or the possibility of her falling. It was from the feel of her bony, wrinkly ass in my hands while I was helping her down. However, we were there to serve. One day, I was substituting on the pump truck when we had what is called a resuscitator run. This was usually a choking victim or a heart attack victim. We got inside the caller's home and were directed to the bedroom. The person in question was lying face down on the bed, his forehand resting on the back of his hand. My captain put both hands under the guy's outstretched elbow and proceeded to flip him over. By this time, rigor mortis had set in, making the elbow a handy flipping lever. Once the captain had the guy on his back, he sent me out to the truck to get the oxygen tank. I couldn't figure out why. The guy was an ugly shade of blue and obviously dead. Anyhow, I grabbed the tank and came back in. The captain then slapped the face mask on our victim and turned the oxygen on. He let it run for 30 seconds and then turned it off. We packed it up. he delivered the bad news to the widow. As soon as we were on the pumper truck and on our way back to the station, I asked him why he had put the oxygen on the guy since he was so obviously dead. He told me that he thought the wife was watching him, and just in case, she saw the evening news and the reporter said firefighters administered oxygen, but so-and-so was pronounced dead at the scene. She wouldn't contest it. Good PR and CYA. A few of my firefighter pals came over to my place one afternoon for beer and poker. We sat at my dinette table. This is one of those cheap-ass metal formica-topped piece-of-junk tables with the plastic-covered chairs and tubular metal legs. Had I bought this dinette set, the caps that typically go on the bottom of the metal chair legs might have been there. As it was, though, I found this handsome dinette set on someone's tree lawn. We were four or five beers into this high-stakes game when I took a swallow of beer, looked at my cards, anteed up, set the cards on the table, and reached under the chair seat, picked it up to move it closer to the table. I set the chair down and sat on it all in one motion. The right chair leg, with its bare, ragged metal end, came down on the top of my little toe, ripping the skin off the top and down the side. The shock and pain were immediate and intense. I jumped up, grabbed my foot, screamed, bled, and hopped around the kitchen like a man who had just smashed a ragged, metal-edged chair leg on top of his little toe by using his full weight and mother gravity. I was beside myself in pain. My idiot friends, who at first had no idea what was going on, just stared at me. Within seconds, I saw the blood seeping through my fingers, put two and two together, and instantly became apoplectic with laughter. Later, my friend Bill said he was looking around on the floor to see if he could find my toe. Fortunately, it was still attached. I've had my share of painful experiences in my life. This one was by far the most painful. However, it wasn't the worst. The following week, I had the same bunch of guys over, pretty much doing the same thing at the same table. At some point during our drunken card-playing activities, I lifted the same chair, and it came crashing down on the same toe. My sympathetic, or pathetic, friends knew immediately what had happened. The whole episode, from the shock, pain, bleeding, grabbing my toe, and hopping around the kitchen, and them laughing their asses off, was identical to the previous week, with the only difference being that this time it hurt even worse. It's the kind of pain that brings tears to your eyes, but you're not really crying. It's the kind of pain where the anger at yourself for being so stupid to let this happen again is almost as great as the pain itself. Was it life-altering? No. However, to this day, whenever I make the same move with a chair, I click my heels and feet together like Dorothy, slide them forward, and then set the chair down. On a couple of occasions, I've walked into burning buildings with a fire hose in hand. I helped other firefighters carry hoses into a burning building. I cut many a hole in walls and doors and holes in roofs. I hung on to the business end of a hose while perched 30 feet up at the top of the extended ladder from a truck, shooting water into a burning, abandoned, all-wooden structure in the dead of winter. I didn't get that cold. I thought it was really amazing that icicles formed so quickly and hung down from the brim of my helmet, and equally amazing to see the same icicles on my fellow firefighters' mustaches and eyebrows. But for the most part, I didn't directly save anyone's life. In some cases, I'm not sure I would have had the strength to do it. Rugged Ron was the unofficial name of a 180-pound dummy we used for training. The idea was to see if or how well you could move or transport this average, lifeless, dead-weight adult male. As a group, we went through various techniques to save Rugged Ron. After this initial demonstration, my captain had us put Rugged Ron at the top of the stairs and said, "Okay, Tidyman, go save his life." I can't fully describe the ridiculous and futile struggle that followed. It looked like I was having a losing wrestling match with a dead guy. I tried everything I had just learned, but to no avail. The only thing I managed to do was work up a good sweat and subsequently warn my fellow firefighters that if they were in a dangerous situation and unconscious, Tidyman might not be the best bet for being rescued alive. By then, the only thing I could think to do was to slide Ron to the head of the stairs and give him a shove. No, not the correct procedure. Fortunately, I was never in a situation where I had to move someone that size. If the situation had ever come up, my first move would have been to look for help. All firehouses were equipped with kitchens, and frequently various crew members brought in ingredients for the day's meals. Sometimes they piled into the fire truck, grabbed the two-way radio, and headed to the grocery store. Most of the time, when you see a fire truck at a grocery store, you might think there was an emergency nearby. More often than not, the crew is there picking up groceries for the station. And have you ever noticed they're always parked in the fire lane? Enough firefighters in a given station usually love to cook, sparing the rest from that chore if they did not. I was one who did. After the first time I prepared a meal, most of the crew in my station gladly included themselves when they were asked, "Are you in the cook shack?" What that meant was, did you want to eat what the cook was preparing or not? In short, you were either in or out. One day, Captain Chuck asked one of the new guys, Mark, if he was going to be in the cook shack. I guess all Mark knew was that he was being asked if he wanted to join the rest of us for dinner. Unfortunately, that was all he knew. So he asked Chuck, "What are we having?" Chuck replied, "Doesn't make any difference. You're out." Mark said, "What do you mean I'm out?" Chuck said, "If you have to ask, you're not in. You asked, you're out." Tough lesson in firehouse etiquette. I came into the fire station one day and asked if anyone had seen Stan, the hook and ladder driver from the earlier shift. "Yeah," someone said, "there's a woman upstairs named Cheryl giving him head." I wouldn't say that such an event was entirely unheard of, but it did strike me as highly unusual. I said, "I beg your pardon?" It was repeated. Stan was upstairs getting head. "Okay, run this by me again. Who is Cheryl, and why is she upstairs with Stan?" It turned out that Cheryl was a young lady who had walked into the fire station one day and let it be known that if anyone was interested, she would like to do him this favor. For free. Anyone. Really. And Cheryl is pretty cute. Decent body, slim hips, short blonde hair, and oddly enough, a quick smile. Cheryl just happened to love firefighters. Not police, not teachers, not doctors, not pest control agents, not shoe salesmen, just firefighters. That part is understandable, since we are America's heroes. She liked them so much, she would show this appreciation by giving as many firefighters as possible this free, intimate attention. I think she had a slight, maybe considerable, oral fixation working for her, and us, as well. I never worked as a psychologist, but there might have been a slight self-esteem issue going on here also. She might start around 2 in the afternoon and make the rounds of 3 or 4 firehouses before she was done for the day. Where was the captain while all this was going on? He was not getting the same attention, but he wasn't doing anything to keep the rest of us from partaking. I asked, "So what's the deal? Is there a line for me? Do you have to ask her nicely? You don't have to kiss her, do you?" Mike said, "Tidy. If you want one, just get in line. I'm after Stan, you're after me. When I come downstairs, you go up. She's in the kitchen." She was, and I did. I'm not saying it was a great experience because it was free. I'm saying it was great. Period. One night while on duty, I was with Cheryl when the alarm came in. Whoops, gotta go. I wasn't too upset. I figured I was very fortunate to participate in this 1.5 times and be a part of KCMO Fire Department folklore. The Cheryl era lasted a couple of months. I'm not sure why it ended. Bill, my best friend in Kansas City, was one of the firefighters I met when I started laying asphalt with Dale. Bill was an ex-Marine. At the time, he was a notorious womanizer, a heavy drinker, when the occasion called for it, and a firefighter so fearless that he earned the sobriquet Wild Bill. A decent-sized guy, he wore a Fu Manchu mustache, considered stylish at the time. We started hanging out together long before I became a firefighter. We had a lot in common, such as drinking, shooting pool, chasing women, playing tennis and racquetball, etc. In tennis and racquetball, we were pretty even. Bill excelled a bit in the drinking department and usually beat me in pool. In hooking up with women, he made me look like a grade school student. He really was a legend in the babe department. Have you ever ridden in a car with someone whose work is evident all over town, like a construction worker or real estate agent? They might pepper the conversation with questions like, "Hey, see that building over there? I built it." Or, "See that house over there? I just sold it last week." Bill did the same, but the subject was women and sex. "Jim, see that apartment complex over there? I got laid." Or, "Tidy, see that street we just passed? I got laid there 2 days ago. Women lives halfway down the hall on the left." No, on the right. He might have been bragging a bit, but for the most part, he was just stating a fact. Every other time we went out to shoot pool or go drinking or both, he'd end up going home with a different woman. His lofty goal was to go to bed with every good-looking woman in Kansas City. Probably an impossible goal, but I admired his ambition. Bill had some assets, obviously. Even so, I asked him once what his secret was. So much of the male population of Kansas City lagged behind him. He said, "It's no big deal. I scope out the woman I want to go home with. I can tell right away if there's a mutual attraction. If there is, I get to it pretty quickly." "Get to what?" I asked. "I just ask her if she's interested in going to bed with me." 9 out of 10 times the answer is no. But if you can handle the first 9 rejections, number 10 comes around pretty quick. Bill said that he didn't stick around to sweet-talk his way with the ones who said no. He reasoned, "Who's got time for that?" It was always fun hanging out with him. He was energetic, highly competitive, funny, and at times a marvel. I wonder what he's up to now, or with whom. One day, while sitting around the station shooting the breeze, I brought up the subject of skydiving.